Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust and Litigation Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, July 16, 2014, during a live Teleform Courthouse Steps conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleform conference call on fraud on the market, the Supreme Court's decision in Halliburton v. Erica P. John Fund. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome one expert, Mr. George T. Conway III, who is a partner at Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, who is going to give us an overview of the case and discuss the decision. A more complete bio for Mr. Conway was provided to you in advance, and so I'll stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. So with that, Mr. Conway, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Christian. The Halliburton case is about the most, the subject of the Halliburton case was the most powerful, or is the most powerful engine of civil liability ever created by mankind. And that engine of liability is Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, and SEC Rule 10b-5 promulgated thereunder. The most remarkable thing about Section 10b, the Section 10b Rule 10b-5 private right of action, is that it actually doesn't exist. At least you can't find it in the statute. It's not there because Congress didn't create it. When it enacted the 1933 and 1934 securities laws, Congress did create a whole bunch. It created seven, to be exact, express private rights. A couple of them deal with registration statements and prospectuses and public offerings. There's one dealing with manipulation of securities prices, another dealing with false statements in periodic reports by securities issuers that affect secondary market trading. But it didn't create a private right of action in Section 10B. As to the express private rights it created, Congress debated those provisions at length, and it weighed carefully the need to create remedies for fraud without creating excessive and costly devices for litigation. And it was precise about who could be sued and what they had to show. But those express remedies pale in importance today compared to Section 10B and Rule 10b-5. Section 10B makes it illegal, in connection with the purchase or sale of any security, to use or employ any deceptive device or contrivance in violation of SEC rules, and Section 10, Rule 10b-5 is a rule promulgated under Section 10b that prohibits misstatements or false or misleading statements in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. The statute only provides that the SEC can enforce those rules, but starting in the 1940s and in the 50s and 60s, the courts began recognizing, implying a private right of action under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5. And in 1971, the Supreme Court, in a case called Banker's Life, basically just assumed the existence of this private right of action in a footnote, in a conclusory one-sentence footnote that simply cited a treatise on securities regulation. Now, of course, today you couldn't have that. You couldn't have – the courts will not imply judicially create a private right of action. The only rights of action that are permissible today – are at rights of action that Congress expressly provide for by statute. But nevertheless, because of the rule of stare decisis, the court has maintained Section 10b and retained Section 10b and recognized it and decided a lot of cases under Section 10b. And the courts have had to struggle with the task of defining the elements of Section 10b, and that's a difficult task because the statute doesn't actually define those elements. The statute only says what's illegal. They don't say who can sue, and they don't say what the people who can sue have to show in order to get damages. But what the courts have done as a starting point is to model the Section 10b, Rule 10b-5 right of action after claims of common law fraud. And that means you have to show a false or misleading statement, intent to deceive, reliance, causation, and damages. Beyond that, what the Supreme Court has done in fleshing out the elements of the implied right of action is, in recent years, the court has tried to cabin the Section 10b right of action by looking to express aspects of the express rights of action in the 33 and 34 acts and looking for analogies and borrowing from the statute, the express rights, to define elements of the aspects of the Section 10b-5 right of action, Rule 10b-5 right of action. Now, the element at issue in Halliburton was reliance. For common law fraud, that would mean that you, or the buyer or a seller or something, maybe usually the buyer, actually saw or heard some statement by the other party to the transaction that they then relied upon and acted upon in deciding to engage in a transaction. Guy tells me a horse is great, it plows great, and I believe him. I buy the horse and act on his representation. Turns out the horse dies when I put him out on the field. I relied because I heard what the guy told me and I acted on it. But what happened under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5 litigation is that the courts began to relax the reliance element in cases involving publicly traded securities. And the fundamental reason they did that, and this happened in the 1970s and 80s, was to facilitate class actions. Now, to have a damages class action under Rule 23b-3, the plaintiff has to show that common issues predominate over individual ones. But if everyone had to show actual reliance, that they had eyeball and eardrum reliance, that they heard and saw and relied on the statement, then everybody would have to testify, everybody in the class would have to testify, and individual issues would predominate over common issues, and you wouldn't be able to have a class action. So the lower court said, we're going to presume reliance when the stock trades on open and efficient markets. And they said that it made sense to do that because people who buy stocks on the open market, publicly traded securities, they rely not so much on what the issuers actually say, but they rely on the integrity of the market prices. They assume that the open market price is not affected by fraud, and they rely on the integrity of that price. And so plaintiffs shouldn't have to show individual reliance with publicly traded securities on efficient markets. They should simply have to show that the market was publicly traded, that it was a public market, and it was efficient, that the market was efficient. And that was called, they call that the fraud on the market presumption of reliance, and that's what enables class actions under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5. The Supreme Court, the lower courts developed that in the 70s and 80s, and the Supreme Court adopted it as a law of the land in 1988 in Basic against Levinson, which was the precedent at issue in Halliburton. And there are three remarkable things about Basic versus Levinson in retrospect. The first was that the fraud on the market presumption of reliance actually wasn't the important issue in the case. The first question presented in Basic was actually something quite different. It was about the materiality of merger negotiations, and I remember at the time everybody was focused on Basic as being a case about merger negotiation materiality. There was less briefing on the fraud on the market presumption issue, even though that has become the most important element of the Section 10b-5 cause of action since then. Few people really appreciated the importance of the Section 10b-5, the fraud on the market presumption issue at the time. The second interesting thing about Basic against Levinson was that the Reagan administration actually supported the plaintiffs. The Justice Department at the time was very much enamored of Chicago School economics, and one of the rationales of the fraud on the market presumption is that it's consistent with the efficient capital markets hypothesis, which is the economic theory that stock prices reflect all publicly available information on publicly available information in markets. The third thing was the composition of the court in Basic. Three of the more conservative justices didn't participate in Basic. Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Scalia were recused, and Justice Kennedy had not yet been confirmed at the time of the argument, although he was confirmed by the time the decision was made, but he didn't participate. So you had six justices, a bare quorum of the court, participating with three of the more conservative votes out. And those votes might have made a difference because the result on the fraud on the market presumption was a bare majority of the bare quorum. It was 4-2. The majority opinion was written by Justice Blackmun, who was joined by Justices Brennan, Marshall, and Stevens. The majority upheld the fraud on the market theory and relied on the Justice Department's economic rationale and engaged in essentially no textual or historical analysis of the statute. They held, basically on policy grounds, that there should be a presumption of reliance, and they held that the presumption of reliance was rebuttable. Justice White, joined by Justice O'Connor, dissented, and dissented quite vigorously. He criticized the court for relying on what was then a novel economic theory, and he pointed out that in 1934, Congress actually created an analogous express right against issuers for statements that issuers make that affect secondary market trading, and that's Section 18 of the 1934 Act. And in Section 18 of the 1934 Act, Justice White noted, Congress expressly imposed the requirement of reliance. And not only that, the legislative history discussed the necessity of an element of reliance, and you have statements from members and witnesses before congressional committees talking about how if you don't require reliance, you're going to open up, you're going to create a vehicle for blackmail by litigation against issuers. Justice White was also quite prescient in what would ensue after BASIC. He talked about the effect of the presumption would be to create massive judgments that would be ultimately paid for by shareholders for the benefit, frankly, of lawyers. And in the 25 years since BASIC was handed down, that's exactly what happened. A massive multi-billion dollar industry of securities litigation has sprung up. And the two things that fueled, the two aspects of Section 10b that fueled that massive industry are, first, the absence of a privity requirement under Section 10b. Under common law fraud, typically under common law fraud claims, there has to be privity between the person who's suing and the defendant. In other words, like if I buy a horse from Christian, I could sue him, but I can't sue somebody else. I have to sue the person I bought the security or the product from. But that's not the case with Section 10b. You can sue anybody who makes a false or misleading statement in connection with the purchase of sale of a security, including, you know, in here, issuers. The second aspect was, of course, the fraud on the market theory. And the combination of the fraud on the market theory of reliance, which facilitates class action, and the absence of a privity requirement means that you could sue issuers of securities for secondary market trading and have massive classes of basically everyone who purchases the stock of a company over a long period of time against that company. So if I purchase a security from Christian, or I purchased it on the open market, and I'm not purchasing it from the company, if the stock is inflated by an alleged false statement by the company, then I can sue the company, even though the company didn't sell me the security. And the result of that is a bizarre system whereby shareholders essentially pay judgments and settlements to other shareholders, because if the company settles that claim, well, the people who are paying that claim are ultimately the shareholders, either through insurance premiums, which are massive. You know, there are massive insurance premiums that are insured because companies take out policies against this kind of litigation, or directly out of the corporate treasury. And the people who really benefit from this are not shareholders, because the shareholders are ultimately paying for themselves, but the people who take a little slice of the money as it goes from the company to shareholders, or from some shareholders to other shareholders, and namely plaintiff lawyers and defense lawyers and all of the service providers that do work on securities litigation, and also insurance companies, and now especially economic experts, as we'll see. Now to Halliburton. Halliburton arises because of the critical importance of class certification in Section 10b-5 litigation. Most cases settle, and most cases settle because companies simply can't risk going to trial and the risk of a massive judgment, because the potential damages are so great. And typically, most cases settle before trial, virtually all cases settle before trial, for a relatively small percentage of the potential damages. So if a relatively small percentage, usually under 10% and sometimes even under 5%. So when you see a settlement in the newspaper of $100 million in a private Section 10b-5 action, that doesn't necessarily mean that the plaintiffs had this wonderful case. What it typically means is the potential damages and the potential size of a judgment, if the case actually went to trial and an adverse jury verdict were rendered, would be in the billions of dollars. So because of the importance of the class action, defendants have been looking for ways in the last 15 years or so to cut back, to make it harder to certify a class. and they focused on the elements of the fraud on the market presumption and tried to make various arguments that the fraud on the market presumption shouldn't apply in particular cases. And one argument that the defendants successfully made in the Fifth Circuit was the subject of the first Halliburton decision. Halliburton went up twice this year, but it also went up in 2001 to the Supreme Court. And in 2011, the issue on the first trip to the Supreme Court that Halliburton made was whether or not plaintiffs had to prove loss causation in order to establish the applicability of the fraud on the market presumption. And that's the rule that the Fifth Circuit had adopted in some prior cases. Now, loss causation is a substantive element of a Rule 10b-5 claim, and it basically requires the plaintiff to show that the losses that they suffered were the result of the alleged misstatement of which they complained. And the typical way that a plaintiff shows that is by showing that when the misstatement was corrected, when the truth came out about the company, right, the widget, that the widgets were defective, and they weren't great widgets as the company had represented in years past, the stock dropped. And if the stock drops when the truth comes out, that means that the loss was caused by the misstatements, because the misstatements had inflated the price of the stock at the time that the plaintiff purchased, and they paid that extra amount. That extra amount came out of the stock when the fraud was revealed, and that's the plaintiff's loss, and it was caused by the misstatement. Now, the Supreme Court held unanimously that loss causation was not part, an element or a requirement or a prerequisite of the fraud on the market presumption, and held that it was not relevant to the class certification inquiry. And the reason the Supreme Court held that unanimously in Halliburton 1 in 2011 was that the court said that fraud on the market is about how price is affected by the fraud when the plaintiff buys the stock. In other words, whether the stock at the time that the plaintiff buys is affected by the misstatement and the price is inflated. And it's not about, the fraud on the market theory isn't about what happens to the price when the fraud is revealed later. Now, Halliburton tried to make a pretty good argument, actually, that, well, it's really the same thing. The Fifth Circuit used the words loss causation, but it really meant price impact at the time of purchase, because they're really kind of the same thing, because if the stock drops when the misstatements are corrected on the back end, well, that can only be because there was inflation in the stock from the misstatements in the first place, and the misstatements had a price impact. So what the Fifth Circuit was really saying was that price impact was required in order to certify, in order to invoke the fraud on the market presumption of reliance and therefore certify a class. Supreme Court said, no. The Fifth Circuit said loss causation. We assume they meant what they said. They didn't mean price impact. And so the Supreme Court unanimously reversed. Now, 2 years later, another important case on the fraud on the market presumption of reliance came up, and it was called Amgen, involving the pharmaceutical manufacturer. I think it was a biotech company, actually. The argument there that the defendants made was that the plaintiffs had to show that an alleged misstatement was material in order to invoke the fraud on the market presumption of reliance and get a class certified. The defendant, Amgen, argued, yes, that's part and parcel of what the plaintiff has to show to get a class certified and to invoke the fraud on the market presumption. And they had a pretty good argument under BASIC, because BASIC actually talked about materiality being a prerequisite for the fraud on the market presumption. And that makes sense, because only material misstatements are the ones that affect the price on which investors are presumed to rely. If the misstatements aren't material, if they don't matter to investors, then typically that's because they don't affect the price. And if there's no effect, no impact, no price impact of the misstatement, then relying on the price, then the investors relying on the price of the stock can't be equated with indirectly relying on the misstatement. The misstatement didn't affect the price. And so there's no basis to presume reliance on the misstatement. The Supreme Court rejected this argument by a vote of 6-3. And Justice Ginsburg wrote the opinion, and the opinion wasn't actually based upon the parameters of the fraud on the market theory as such, but rather on Rule 23b-3. Rule 23b-3 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure requires that common issues be shown to predominate over individual ones, as I mentioned. And the court held that materiality was irrelevant to the section, to the Rule 23b3 predominance inquiry. And here's why. Listen carefully. What the court said was, if there is no materiality, that not only means that the fraud on the market presumption can't apply, it also means that nobody in the class can have a claim. And that's because materiality is an element of a Rule 10b-5 claim. There has to be a material misstatement of fact in order for somebody to bring a 10b-5 claim. And if there's no materiality, then nobody has a claim in the class, and then all the claims of the potential class members fall together, which means that because everybody goes away, the common issues predominate. You never get to the individual reliance issues, even though the fraud on the market presumption doesn't apply. You don't get to the individual reliance issues because it's moot. Everybody's gone already because all claims are gone already because there was no material misstatement. So materiality doesn't matter there. Now, if there is materiality, and you can have a class action. Now, if there is materiality, then the fraud on the market presumption does apply, and you don't have to deal with issues of individual reliance. So if there is materiality, common issues also predominate. You can also have a rule, a 23b3 class. So whether or not you have materiality makes no difference, the court reasoned. If plaintiffs don't have to show it to get the class certified, because either whether or not there's materiality, the common issues will predominate. And not only that, the court held that defendants can't rebut the presumption by showing that materiality doesn't exist, because, again, it's irrelevant to the question of Rule 23b3 predominance, QED. Now, I'm not sure I like the result in Amgen, but the logic is actually unimpeachable. Now, the lineup in Amgen was very important, 6-3. Justice Ginsburg's opinion was joined by Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, and also by the Chief Justice and Justice Alito. The dissenters were Justice Thomas, Justice Scalia, and Justice Kennedy. And what was important about the dissent, in particular Justice Thomas's dissent, which was joined by Scalia and Kennedy, was footnote 4, which called BASIC into question. Justice Thomas's footnote said that BASIC was questionable for the reasons that Justice White had articulated in Justice White's dissent in BASIC. And so you had three justices hinting that they might be willing to overrule BASIC. And then there was one more justice, Justice Alito, who joined the majority in Amgen, wrote an opinion, a concurring opinion, where he suggested that reconsideration of the BASIC presumption may be appropriate because it rested on faulty economic premises. And so you had four justices openly hinting that they would be willing to reconsider BASIC. Now, to go back to Halliburton, Halliburton went back to the Fifth Circuit after the 2011 Supreme Court decision. And in the Fifth Circuit, the defendants argued that, okay, even though, as the Supreme Court held, loss causation isn't required for a plaintiff to get a class certified, price impact is. And that's because if the plaintiff can't show that the misstatement impacted the price, then it makes no sense to apply the presumption of reliance, because if the stock price didn't reflect the misstatement, then relying on the stock price isn't tantamount to relying on the misstatement, because the misstatement didn't affect the price. The Fifth Circuit said, no, no, no. Relying on Amgen. Price impact, the Fifth Circuit held, was irrelevant for the exact same reason why materiality wasn't relevant. The court said that if there's no price impact, no one has a claim. And now that's not because price impact is an element of the claim. It's because price impact, you can't have price impact without loss causation, is what the court held. And loss causation is an element. So what the court was saying there was, well, if there is no loss causation, if there is no price impact, in other words, there was no inflation of the stock at the time as a result of the misstatement when the investor purchased the stock, then by definition, when the alleged misstatement is corrected, since it didn't have the misstatement didn't have an effect on the price in the first place, there was no loss causation, and anything the stock did when the truth came out can't have resulted from the misstatement, which didn't affect the price in the first place. So since loss causation is an essential element of the claim, if there's no price impact, and if there can be no loss causation, if there's no price impact, then everyone's claims fail, just as everyone's claims fail if there's no materiality, and all claims fall together, and common issues predominate over individual ones if there's no price impact. And if there is price impact, well, then you have the fraud on the market theory of reliance, and people don't have to show individual reliance, and therefore, again, common issues predominate. So whether or not price impact exists one way or the other doesn't affect the Rule 23b3 predominance inquiry. Again, QED. So Halliburton, again, reasoning that actually is kind of unimpeachable, much as one might not like the result. So Halliburton then petitions for certiorari and raising two questions. The first one is taking up the invitation to ask for the overruling of BASIC. And the second one is the question of whether or not plaintiffs had to show price impact on a motion for class certification, or alternatively, whether defendants could rebut the presumption by showing a lack of price impact. And this set up basically what was the Super Bowl, or probably I should say in light of recent events, the World Cup of securities litigation. Tens of billions of dollars in settlements and attorney's fees and whatnot were at stake here. Because this was, securities litigation is fundamentally, there are provisions of a couple of the express rights do have a lot of litigation, sections 11 and 12 of the 33 Act, but most securities litigation and most of what you read about with these huge settlements and huge attorney's fees is section 10b litigation. And none of that, by and large, that wouldn't exist without the fraud in the market presumption. So this was the biggest thing in securities litigation ever. And Halliburton launched a full-fledged attack on the economic premises of the fraud on the market presumption, pointing out that the world has changed, at least the world's perception of the efficient capital market hypothesis, which the court cited in BASIC, has changed over 25 years. Back then, people presumed that stock prices efficiently incorporated all publicly available information, or at least that seemed to be the prevailing view. But since then, there's been a lot of economic research and a lot of criticism of the efficient capital market hypothesis, and people are now, there are different versions of the ECMH, and some people question whether markets are really truly efficient at all in a lot of situations. And in fact, in 2013, the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics was given to two economists who had completely opposing views of the efficient capital markets hypothesis. In addition, Halliburton argued that the BASIC was the result of faulty economic assumptions, which the court was in no position to assess, just as Justice White had pointed out in his dissent 25 years earlier, and therefore the changing views of the economists should provide a justification for overruling BASIC. And another argument that Halliburton and its amici made, including a group of amici of former SEC commissioners and SEC officials that I represented, led by Professor Joseph Brunfest of Stanford, argued that BASIC against Levinson is inconsistent with the way the Supreme Court has gone about interpreting and fleshing out the Rule 10b-5 right of action in recent years. And as I mentioned earlier, what the Supreme Court has been doing of late is filling in the interstices of Rule 10b-5 by looking to the express rights of action and borrowing limitations from the express rights of action and importing them into Section 10b. And what we argued here was, well, if you do that with BASIC, well, the closest analogy to BASIC was, if you do that as to Rule 10b-5, the closest analogy of the Rule 10b-5 implied right against issuers for secondary trading, the closest analogy was Section 18 of the Exchange Act, the very provision that Justice White relied upon in his dissent in BASIC. And that requires actual reliance. And if you want to make the statute, if you want to make the 10b-5 right closer to what Congress actually intended, even though Congress didn't intend a 10b-5 right of action at all, you should borrow the reliance requirement from Section 18. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, Those were two of the principal arguments that the defense made. But to make a long story short, the Supreme Court rejected those arguments. And Chief Justice Roberts wrote an opinion for the court for six justices, including Justice Kennedy, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer, Justice Kagan, and Justice Sotomayor, rejecting the argument that BASIC should be overruled and relying on the principle of stare decisis, and in particular, the fact that stare decisis applies with special force in the case of statutes, because in the case of statutes, as opposed to constitutional litigation, Congress can correct whatever mistakes the court it perceives the court to have made, which is not the case with constitutional litigation. And the court, applying the doctrine of stare, this reinforced this powerful version of stare decisis that applies to statutes, said that the defendants would have to provide a special justification for overruling BASIC, and that the defendants had not done that. And in particular, the majority dispensed with the argument relied on principally by Halliburton that the changing perception of the validity of the efficient capital market hypothesis served as a basis for overruling BASIC. And what the court said there was that if you look at BASIC, and in particular footnote 24 of BASIC, the Supreme Court wasn't really adopting any particular form of the efficient capital market hypothesis. In fact, it said it was not. And what the court was simply doing was making an assumption that most of the time in publicly traded markets, information affects price. And the Supreme Court in Halliburton noted that not even Halliburton disputes that proposition. Indeed, Eugene Fama, who was a fellow who won the Nobel Prize last year for criticizing the efficient capital markets, not even he disputes that proposition either. It's just a question of a degree of efficiency, and the Supreme Court really wasn't adopting a view that markets had to be perfectly efficient. In addition, the court rejected the suggestion that it was illegitimate or wrong to presume that investors rely on the integrity of market prices. One of the things that Halliburton and Amici made was there are a lot of people out there who don't really rely on the integrity of market prices. In fact, they think they can beat the market. They don't actually assume that the market affects true value. And in fact, there Vivendi, one amicus Vivendi, who is the subject of a massive securities 10b-5 judgment in the Southern District of New York, actually pointed out that one of the major plaintiffs in its case actually bought more of its stock when the supposed fraud was revealed because it viewed Vivendi stock as undervalued. So people don't necessarily rely on the integrity of market prices, which is what a central premise of BASIC. And what the Supreme Court said was, well, again, that may be true in some cases, but in most cases, people do rely on the integrity of market prices. As for the argument that Section 18 provided the best analogy and should be borrowed from, and its reliance requirement should be borrowed from and imported into Section 10b, the Supreme Court said, well, Justice White made that argument in BASIC, and the court presumably rejected it because it did not accept that argument, even though it didn't really discuss it. Now, on that basis, the Supreme Court refused to overrule BASIC. Next, the Supreme Court dealt with the argument presented in question presented two, which is whether or not plaintiffs would have to show price impact upon class to get a class certified, or whether the defendants could rebut it. And the Supreme Court held that no, plaintiffs did not have to demonstrate price impact to get a class certified, but the defendants could rebut the presumption by showing lack of price impact. And the rationale essentially there was the Supreme Court said that in the case of requiring to require that price impact be affirmatively shown would essentially overrule half of BASIC, because one of the two premises of BASIC was that, generally speaking, misstatements affect market price. And so it didn't make any sense to the other aspect, the other assumption behind BASIC was that people rely on the market price. But to say that the plaintiffs had to demonstrate price impact would essentially overrule half the presumption. The Supreme Court said we're not going to do that for the same reasons that we're not going to overrule BASIC altogether. But as to the question of whether the defendants could rebut price impact, the court took a difference too. The court addressed the argument that the plaintiffs in Halliburton made and that the Fifth Circuit had adopted that, look, price impact is no different really than materiality, which you said we didn't have, the plaintiffs did, was irrelevant to the class certification inquiry in Amgen. And it's very closely related. The EPJ fund, the court wrote, argues that much of the foregoing, which is the discussion of Amgen, could be said of price impact. What could be said about materiality could be said of price impact. And the court said there, fair enough, period. It essentially conceded the validity of the argument, but then proceeded to distinguish price impact from materiality. It said that given that the other basic prerequisites must still be proved at the class certification stage, the common issue of materiality can be left to the merit stage without risking the certification of classes in which individual issues will end up overwhelming common ones. And because materiality is a discrete issue that can be resolved in isolation from the other prerequisites, it can be wholly confined to the merit stage. Price impact is different, the court went on. The fact that a misrepresentation was reflected in the market price at the time of the transaction is BASIC's fundamental premise. So they said, it's different. But they never really explain why it's different, and they never really answer, which is the most surprising thing about Halliburton, the point that if there's no price impact, then there's no materiality. If there's no materiality, typically there's no price impact, and there's no loss causation. All these three things go together. And yet the Supreme Court held that loss causation in Halliburton 1 and materiality in Amgen aren't relevant to the Rule 23b3 inquiry because if you don't have those, you can't have a claim, and yet treated price impact differently here in Halliburton 2, even though it's hard to imagine how a claims could survive, the class's claims could survive if there's no price impact. So it's very unsatisfactory how the Supreme Court addressed Amgen, but nonetheless, it's now the law that notwithstanding Amgen, defendants can seek to rebut the fraud on the market presumption by showing a lack of price impact resulting from the misstatement. Now, the dissent, in a nutshell, followed the adopted defense criticisms of the fraud on the market presumption and BASIC's reliance on the efficient capital market hypothesis, and also argued that the presumption of reliance was inconsistent with the Supreme Court's recent Rule 23 requirements, as to which, you know, requiring that people, that the plaintiffs actually show that the elements or the requirements of Rule 23 have been complied with. As for stare decisis, the dissent, Justice Thomas, joined by Justices Scalia and Alito, essentially said, look, yes, we understand that statutes have more forces required to overrule a statutory ruling than a constitutional ruling, but here, the Supreme Court actually, in BASIC, wasn't actually interpreting the statute. And it created a right of action that Congress didn't create, and then created this rule and grafted onto a right of action, again, that Congress didn't create. It was totally the Supreme Court's doing, and Justice Thomas argued, we created this mess, and we should have to clean it up. But that was to no avail. The Supreme Court declined to overrule BASIC, and The ramifications of that are that the engine, this great engine of civil liability, which produces tens of billions of dollars of settlements year in, year out, and attorney fees will continue. In terms of the effect of the Supreme Court's ruling that defendants could rebut the fraud on the market presumption with evidence of price impact, that's probably a marginal victory for defendants. It's going to enable defendants to do what the Supreme Court said couldn't be done in Amgen. In Amgen, for example, they argued on the basis that the defendants argued that the statements, the alleged misstatements, were immaterial because there were all sorts of statements inconsistent with the alleged misstatements that were out there in the public, and so therefore the alleged misstatements couldn't have affected the market price. Now you can basically do the same thing as long as you sort of take all that information about what was out there in the marketplace, what information was out there in the marketplace, and give it to a Lexicon or a Cornerstone, hire an economist and have an economist do an event study to demonstrate that in light of the information out there in the market, there was no price impact from the alleged misstatements. So the defendants did get something back. Now, the issue was going to be in the lower court, you know, in order to see how significant that's going, a victory that is for the defendants, it's going to depend on how seriously or how tough the district courts and the courts of appeals make the burden on defendants. And they're going to have to wrestle, and the courts are going to have to wrestle, and they're not going to, and it's very difficult for them to do that because they're not trained economists, with how strong or what the requirements for an effective presumption rebutting event study will be. One aspect of the decision that might actually help plaintiffs, even though the letting defendants rebut the presumption gives them one more bite at the apple on loss causation and materiality and price impact, one aspect though that might be helpful to plaintiffs is that the Supreme Court made a lot of statements about how the Supreme Court in Basic, under the fraud on the market presumption, wasn't assuming a high level of efficiency in markets. It was just simply making a general presumption that generally markets impound information about the stocks and in particular misstatements. And I think the plaintiffs are probably going to come back and argue that therefore some of the decisions that have come down in recent years that have sort of tightened up on what plaintiffs must show to demonstrate efficiency in order to trigger the broad of the market presumption, they're going to argue that the plaintiffs really don't have to show as much. And so that's one aspect that actually may be helpful to the plaintiffs. And with that, I think I'm ready to take questions.
All right. Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. We'll now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, to ask a question, plus press star and then the pound key, and we've got about 15 minutes for your questions. It looks like we had one caller jump on, so we've got one question, and we'll go through it. We'll go right to it.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I'm particularly interested in the dissenting views of some of the justices and how they affect constitutional analysis, even though it's statutory case. If the courts are creating a cause of action on their own initiative without a statutory basis, constitutionally they can do that, but it becomes an equity decision and not a statutory or a constitutional decision. And if so, if it's an equity decision, it's not supposed to create a precedent. So has anyone explored this line of analysis?
Well, I think the point that you're making is very much related to why the Supreme Court today no longer creates or implies rights of actions in federal statutes. I mean, the Supreme Court, in, for example, a case like Alexander against Sandoval, written by Justice Scalia in 2001, points out that under our constitutional system of separation of powers, Congress writes the laws. And this is, you know, having the court create rights of action where Congress didn't create them is inconsistent with that. And so I think this, what the courts have essentially abandoned, one of the reasons why the courts have, the Supreme Court has abandoned the creation of private rights of action by the courts that aren't actually explicitly in the statute, is respect for the separation of powers. Another reason why they've done it is if you went through the United States Code and looked at every single provision that said thou shalt not do something, and you could create hundreds upon hundreds of rights of action, and judges would do nothing but decide cases under those implied rights. And so the Supreme Court couldn't, and the lower courts couldn't consistently decide which actions, which provisions of the United States Code deserve a private right of action and which don't, other than by relying on what Congress actually says.
All right. Well, if you have a question to ask, we've got still got about 13 minutes or so. So if you and we have no caller or nobody in the queue, so if, again, press star and then the pound key if you would like to ask a question. And then while we're waiting, one quick programming note. Our next scheduled Teleforum conference call will be tomorrow, July 17th at 1 p.m. Eastern, presented by the Administrative Law and Regulation, as well as the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Groups. And that will be a Teleforum on who judges who is a judge. And that features Professor Kristen Hickman from the University of Minnesota Law School, as well as Professor Tuan Samahan from the Villanova University of Law School. And it looks like we had one more question jump on the line.
This is David Burton.
Oh, go ahead.
This is David Burton with the Heritage Foundation. My question is basically, what sort of legislative remedies would you recommend to address the problems with respect to 10b-5? And specifically, you know, what can we do to appropriately structure remedies under 10B?
Well, I mean, two solutions, neither of which I think are politically realistic. One would be to basically say that there is no right of action under Section 10B. I don't think that's ever going to happen. The other would be to overturn the fraud on the market presumption. But I don't, you know, I just don't, I think that the political forces aligned in favor of this industry are probably too strong for that to happen. I mean, the one time the stars did align for significant securities litigation reform was in 1995, and over President Clinton's veto, Congress passed the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. And there were suggestions there to codify the fraud on the market presumption, and there were suggestions that were also reflected in drafts of the legislation to get rid of it. Neither was adopted because there just weren't the votes one way or the other. The one thing that was sort of interesting about the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act that came up in the Halliburton case was that there is actually a provision there that wasn't actually codified in the United States Code, Section 203 of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995, which actually said that nothing in this act, which was all about Section 10B and private securities litigation, shall be construed as authorizing or acquiescing in the implied right of action created by the courts. So, you know, the most that Congress could bring itself to do is to say, hey, Supreme Court, if you want to do something about this, get rid of Section 10, the Rule 10b-5 right of action, you can do this. And actually, the dissent in Halliburton said, well, if Congress were willing to do that, then there's no reason to presume that it is acquiesced in one aspect of the Section 10b, Rule 10b-5 right of action, namely the fraud on the market presumption. So, I mean, those are two things that could be done. I think that anything short of or getting rid of a right of action that is susceptible to this kind of class treatment and where you can sue issuers without privity, anything short of getting rid of the fraud on market presumption or just saying that you can't bring a 10b-5 right of action or that it requires privity, anything short of that is just nibbling around the edges, as shown, frankly, by the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. What happened there was everybody thought, well, we're going to make it harder to easier to get rid of cases by increasing the burden on plaintiffs to demonstrate scienter, and by creating a mechanism whereby only the largest shareholders with the biggest interest in a company could qualify to become a class representative, and none of that has really had a limiting effect on securities litigation. It's just the forces in favor, I mean, the potential liability just encourages people to bring these lawsuits. The judges are hesitant to get rid of these cases on the pleadings, and with the class certification mechanism, unless there's a way to limit the certification of classes, you're just going to continue to see these massive settlements and this enormous engine of liability grind on.
Well, we have just a few minutes left on the call, so I'll go ahead and open it up one more time for questions. Final, last call, press star and then the pound key. One other programming note, in person, we have this Friday, July 18th, in Washington, D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel, our annual Supreme Court roundup. Seats are still available for that, so check out our all-new website at fedsoc.org for details and to register. So, well, it looks like that's it for questions. So, Mr. Conway, I want to thank you very much for joining us on the call today and for being with us. We greatly appreciate it. Do you have anything final, any final remarks that you'd like to make? If not, that's fine.
No, I thank everybody for joining, and I hope they found this informative.
Well, again, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you and our audience for joining us. We always welcome your feedback by email, info@fedsoc.org. Don't forget to join us tomorrow at 1 Eastern for our next scheduled teleform call. So until then, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.